We'll take questions now.
Can you go through some of the highlights of the Bill of Rights?
Certainly. We address numerous levels of care. For example, we talk about in the access to hospital services, wait times for triage and emergency services, that we have established wait times that the patients and our physicians and professional community agree is appropriate and that they be adhered to, so that there ought to be enough staffing, both nursing and physician, to be able to adhere to those times. We also talk about being admitted to a hospital bed within 6 hours of arriving in an emergency room. We now have patients staying 3-4 days at the Royal Columbian sometimes. That patients who are being discharged have the right to know about the arrangements that are being made for their home and rehabilitative care prior to their leaving the hospital, and have an agreed upon plan of care rather than being sent out the door like we're turning out widgets in a factory over and over fast. Palliative care patients should have the right to decide if they want to die at home in a hospice or in an acute palliative care bed. The acute palliative care beds are diminishing at a very fast rate. And just recently at Eagle Ridge, our nurses were nursing a palliative patient on the floor in the emergency triage area. Access to community services. We want to see restorations of full comprehensive programs in the schools for children. We want to see restoration of full prenatal and postnatal community care by registered nurses for moms and their new babes. We want some action on detox services. It's shameful, in fact, that we have put up our supervised injection site with a view to protecting the health of our substance addicted people. And then if they make a decision to detox and seek rehab, we have, first of all, difficulty getting them into detox. And then they should go from detox into rehab right away. We don't have enough residential rehab spaces. And so they go through a cycle of addiction and detox, and never moving off the cycle because of the lack of follow-through support services. Mental health patients. We have a serious crisis with respect to our mental health community right now. We have downsized over the last decade the majority of our mental health services. We have not increased our community mental health services to support them. Our community nurses in the downtown east side report ghastly patient workloads. They have unstable housing arrangements. They're not being supervised and following up with their medications. And so they too stop their medications, revert into their illness pattern, and often become downtown east side victims, and also in other communities, but certainly it's very visible in the downtown east side. Access to seniors care, well, this is something which I'm sure the media must be aware of. Across the province, after the government promised to build new long-term care beds, what they've done is basically reclassified it to get out of their promise. So they're building assisted living beds, or not they, actually they're inviting the private sector to do that, where patients can pay as much as $3,000 to $4,000 a month for living arrangements which don't provide them with adequate nursing supervision and care, and which they have to pay out of their own pocket. And often they're going to have to do this because they have no access to long-term care beds in their communities. There are people who are under the illusion that waiting lists for long-term care beds exist. Our community nurses report to us that no such list exists anymore. They were informed that they should get rid of those lists, and the majority of patients who enter long-term care do so through the emergency rooms now. This is a totally avoidable cost in our healthcare system, which could be managed better. Also, we want to see some planning. We understand that everything that we're believing should be in our healthcare system will not happen overnight, but we want a systematic plan put in place with stable funding from our federal and provincial governments and full consultation with both healthcare providers and the community. Follow up on the very valuable reports which we've already spent millions of dollars for. And finally, access to information. Patients have the right to have information in their records, and they need to know the type of care they're going to get. They need to know, for example, when they enter a long-term care facility, the ratio of registered nurses to long-term care residents. We already started with very difficult ratios, sometimes 40 to 80 residents per registered nurse on a day shift and up to 250 on night shift. We now face a situation where many residents of long-term care have no access to a registered nurse at all, on the night shift and often through the day. This is just totally unacceptable given the multi-diagnoses that most of our seniors have and the rapid nature of change of those conditions. So these are some examples. I've gone on at length, so maybe we'll do another question.
You talked about you want the government, we're on the eve of a provincial budget. I mean, the government has already said it spends most of its money on healthcare. I mean, how much more can it spend?
Well, I think the reason that we see our provincial government spending most of our money on its health care is not that they're putting more into it. It's just the percent of their budget is higher because they lost money from the federal government in the last decade. You know that during the 90s, when Paul Martin was finance minister, the largest reductions in federal financing were enacted in the federal government, drawing billions of dollars out of our health care system. In cash contributions. We believe that our federal government should be restoring their commitment of cash funding to at least 25% in order to make the necessary changes, and that should it be stable funding. It shouldn't be dependent from 1 year to the next on estimates. You know, we already heard the federal government saying, well, we're going to have a surplus, so we'll put some money into health care. Then they thought it was only going to be a $2 billion surplus, so maybe we won't anymore. And then now we see announced yesterday those estimates were again wrong, and now we're going to have a $5 billion surplus. But they're not going to meet with the first ministers until after the election to determine about allocation of monies for health care. What kind of a flim-flam game is this? This is not the way to protect and nurture our most valuable social program. We're aiming at both, but for sure in British Columbia, we're aiming at our provincial government because they are responsible through their own fiscal management. Remember, they gave a humongous tax break the day after they were elected, which emptied our coffers, imposed budgets on our health authorities that did not match inflation, increased utilization, increased technology needs, legislated wage increases, which then forced the health authorities to cut services to meet their balanced budget that they're required to produce. No direction on how to do that, however, so we have situations where health authorities are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars for communications plans to change their logos, hiring consulting firms, Deloitte Touche, the Boston Group, for in excess of $1 million to restructure healthcare in the Vancouver Coastal, giving large bonuses to CEOs who come in at zero budgets. You know, this is blood money. And the people in our long-term care system, people waiting for surgery, waiting for emergency services, they're paying for that.
There seems to be a number of these Bill of Rights items that you're referring to as penny-wise and pound-foolish. Are there any studies that show that spending money now would save us money later or in other budget areas, not just the health budget?
Yeah, there are. For example, if you look at children's health, certainly establishing good health in early childhood and monitoring that health provides long-term savings down the road, particularly if it's coupled with adequate nutrition, a living wage, good housing, and follow-through over time. And that includes both dental and physical health as well as social supports. If you look at support for seniors, there are many studies and many projects which have been very successful at keeping seniors at many levels of infirmity in their homes or in their communities through day programs and other supports in their homes that keep them out of the acute care system. Housing for mental health patients with supervision to ensure that they comply with their treatments stops them from being recycled through the emergency departments. It costs a lot of money for the nurses and physicians at St. Paul's Emergency, for example, to see psychiatric patients who've moved into an acute phase simply because their maintenance regime has not been supported. So these are the types of things that are happening. Sure, we're closing beds, but we're just putting them back into the system someplace else. And I don't know if you folks have been keeping track, but the list of closures is staggering. Let me just read to you a short list that we've compiled, and this isn't comprehensive at all. Since 2001, Kimberly Hospital closed. Delta Hospital ICU closed and acute services were reduced. Sparwood Hospital reduced to a health center. Enderby Hospital reduced to a health center. Bartholomew's Hospital reduced to a D&T. Summerland Hospital, no acute beds in emergency. Vancouver General's surgical short stay unit closed. Penticton Retirement Center, 100 long-term care beds lost. Richmond Emergency Fast Track closed. 16 subacute beds and 4 surgical beds closed. And I know that they're running now with 3 operating rooms closed. This at a time when physicians are crying for operating time. Kootenay Lake Regional Hospital surgical services closed. St. Mary's in New West closing, losing palliative, surgical, and medical beds, as well as important other programs like diabetic care, which is important for keeping diabetics out of our acute care system by ensuring compliance with their health regimes. Eagle Ridge Hospital loses 12 palliative care beds. And it just goes on and on. St. Vincent's, Mount St. Joseph's, there are cuts across the province. Evergreen House at Lionsgate closed a 29-bed unit for seniors. The list is staggering, and its impact on our community is absolutely noticeable, both in terms of the patient's suffering and in terms of the distress, fatigue, and burnout of our healthcare professionals, including nurses and physicians. And I just want to mention to you that in preparing this document, we have consulted with the BCMA, and their representatives are in the room today as well.
Rosa, can you talk? You talked about a patient dying at VGH in the emergency while waiting.
Saying that we're just concerned that patient will die. I have so many stories that, you know, if you, you know, I have a patient that come in and step in having a chest pain, and we have no beds in acute area. So this patient waited for 2 hours, have left to other hospital and found out he has a heart attack. So this is the things that we're very afraid of. We have a young man that come in, nurse, I'm not feeling quite well. What's wrong with you? I don't know. And then it's as a triage nurses, you know, we are nurse, we're not a doctor. We're not able to medically diagnose a patient. So we look at this patient doesn't look very good. Suddenly he just in front of you has respiratory arrest. So, and we have the patient that come in with ambulance ALS crews and with, and that's already, as it said, that patient has a heart attack. So from the echocardiogram ST elevate, so which is mean this patient having a heart attack, and he's waited out there 20 minutes because we're not able to clear the trauma bay to receive the patient. That's all kinds of scary story. I just recently I was working at triage a week ago. I have 3 patients. Someone came in. All 3 seizures patients came in. All 3 seizures, and we're not able to get them in. This is out there. We're waiting to get in. So it's very scary.
So.
Oh, this is very, very normal nowadays that we have to just live with this and we put up with this. And we have a lot of experienced nurses that, look, that's it. I have enough. I'm afraid I'm going to lose my license. That's it. They all resign. So that's what I said. We are unable to retain an experienced registered nurse in ER.
And stories like this go on. Princeton Regional Hospital has, which is on the highway, and it's the last stop before you come through to Hope, has one registered nurse on night shift who covers a huge long-term care area. I think it's about 50 beds, but it may be more. 10 acute medical surgical beds, a labor and delivery room, and the emergency department. And she is it. You know, so you don't want to be having an accident on that highway during the night because, you know, and we hope that this is an experienced nurse, not a brand new one who hasn't had sufficient orientation and advanced training. And this, the story about the chest pain, I think, speaks to the question of penny wise and pound foolish, or whatever it is, the saying is. Because if you can get these patients within that golden hour of their heart attack and give them the clot-busting drugs, which we have, that wonderful advancement in medical treatment, you know, you can avoid further damage to the heart, maybe avoid, you know, cardiac surgeries or other procedures down the road, if that treatment is accessible. It's, you know, and the fact that it wasn't is a shame, because we have it. Vancouver General, this isn't Sparwood, this is Vancouver General. We have the technology, we have the physicians, and we have the medication to have stopped further complication. So it's, in my view, it's almost criminal.
Is there any way you can focus?
So I was just asking about the Campbell River thing where they're hosting seniors at the Ramada Inn. How long have they been doing that?
Actually, they've just announced this in the last several weeks that this is what they plan to do. I don't think they've actually admitted anyone yet, but that is their plan.
Is there any way you can put this document into action?
Well, certainly we're going to be, as I said, placing ads in the newspaper about this document to profile it across the province. And as well, we're going to be engaging our communities in dialogue about this because, as you know, quite frankly, we're facing both a federal and provincial election, and it's time for accountability here. It's time that the public was heard. It's time that the voices of nurses who've been advocating for patient safety and for nurse safety gets heard. Long overdue.